taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I'm glad you could join me. I hope you're having a good summer. I hope the crazy actions that have been going on have not totally destroyed your enjoyment of this wonderful time of year in this country that is so great as we fight to keep our slide into tyranny and despotism. And one of the examples of our slide has been, well, it's been the treatment of free speech. So let me ask you, are there limits on free speech? As President Biden says, are there limits to your freedom of speech, or are there limits to the consequences that can be suffered for actually expressing yourself freely in public? A recent Supreme Court case dealt with exactly that issue. So let's talk about this case.
I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. This quote has been the cry of free speech advocates for decades. But how is society to treat those, especially minors, who violate the standards of speech considered acceptable in public? In the case of Montgomery Area School District VBL, the question is, what are the legitimate actions of public schools in disciplining the vulgar speech of students? In its opinion, the Supreme Court illegitimately applied the First Amendment to state actors, but that's nothing new. By far the most interesting part of the opinion is the role the justices believe schools have in parenting children. And you may be surprised by what the lone dissenter in this case had to say regarding the subject. I don't know about you, but I find vulgar language revolting, especially from the mouth of a young lady. While there was a time in this country when such language was frowned upon, it's much more accepted now. Which brings us to the case of Manoy Area School District VBL, who as a minor was represented by her parents. Now, according to the opinion syllabus, BL failed to make the school's varsity cheerleading squad and reacted by posting vulgar language and gestures on Snapchat. When school officials learned of the post, they suspended BL from the junior varsity squad. After unsuccessfully attempting to reverse the punishment, BL and her parents sought relief in federal court. It seems like I say this a lot, but it's worth repeating. This cannot be a First Amendment violation because Congress had no part in the law. The First Amendment says, quote, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. If what the school did was a violation of BL's freedom of speech, then it was a violation of Article 1, Section 7 of Pennsylvania's Constitution, which reads, quote, the free communication of thoughts and opinions is one of the invaluable rights of man, and every citizen may freely speak, write, and print on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that liberty. Since BL did not sue in state court, but in federal, many people, especially lawyers and judges, claim the 14th Amendment incorporates the First Amendment to the states. However, that's not what the amendment says. Quote, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. Since freedom of speech is protected from state intervention by the constitutions of that state, not the Constitution of the United States, the 14th Amendment doesn't make this a First Amendment issue. At best, had the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania denied BL the privileges or immunities of others within her state, well, then she would have had a 14th Amendment cause, not a First Amendment one. Now, continuing from the court's opinion, quote, BL's Snapchat friends included other Manoy area school students, some of whom also belonged to the cheerleading squad. At least one of them, using a separate cell phone, took pictures of BL's post and shared them with other members of the cheerleading squad. One of the students who received these photos showed them to her mother, who was a cheerleading squad coach, and the images spread. That week, several cheerleaders and other students approached the cheerleading coaches, visibly upset by BL's posts. Questions about the post persisted during an algebra class taught by one of the two coaches. Apparently, Beale's post went to some of the cheerleaders, one of whom showed them to her mother, who happened to be a cheerleading coach. And as the post spread, several students were upset by them, and they approached the coaching staff. In fact, questions about the post persisted during an algebra class taught by one of the coaches. Quote, after discussing the matter with the school principal, the coaches decided that because the post used profanity in connection with a school extracurricular activity, they violated team and school rules. As a result, the coaches suspended BL from the junior varsity cheerleading squad for the upcoming year. BL's subsequent apologies did not move school officials. The school's athletic director, principal, superintendent, and school board all affirmed BL's suspension from the team. In response, BL, together with her parents, filed this lawsuit in federal district court. The question that should have been asked at this time was, is vulgarity considered abuse of freedom of speech in Pennsylvania? Instead, the parents filed a lawsuit in federal court. Now, the district court and the Third Circuit claimed that BL's punishment violated the First Amendment, an opinion I've already debunked. All this was done based on the decision of a previous court in the case of Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. The Manoy Area School District petitioned the Supreme Court, asking it to decide whether Tinker, which holds that public school officials may regulate speech that would materially and substantially disrupt the work and discipline of the school, applies to student speech that occurs off campus. Now, the court held that, quote, while public schools may have a special interest in regulating some off-campus student speech, the special interests offered by the school are not sufficient to overcome BL's interest in free expression in this case. The court explained the Tinker opinion as follows, quote, in Tinker, we indicated that schools have a special interest in regulating on-campus speech that materially disrupts classwork or involves substantial disorder or invasion of the rights of others. The special characteristics that give school additional license to regulate student speech do not always disappear when that speech takes place off campus. Circumstances that may implicate a school's regulatory interests include serious or severe bullying or harassment targeting particular individuals, threats aimed at teachers or other students, the failure to follow rules concerning lessons, the writing of papers, the use of computers or participation in other online school activities, and breaches of school security devices. Notice the language. In Tinker, we indicated that schools have a special interest in regulating on-campus student speech. In other words, it was not the Constitution or the law that granted schools the power to regulate speech, but the Supreme Court. This in itself is a violation of the Constitution, since the judicial power of the United States does not include the legislative or lawmaking power. Are there situations when a school needs the authority to regulate student speech? Yes. Speech that includes bullying, harassment, or other threats are not covered under free speech because it infringes on the rights of others. Now, as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania puts it, that would be an abuse of that liberty. See, it's not within the power of the courts to delegate that power, neither is it within the power of the court to take a state free speech issue and make it a federal one. So by doing so, the court has taken the regulation of student speech to a whole new level. The court does this using a doctrine called in loco parentis, which the Free Legal Dictionary defines as, quote, Latin for in place of the parent, the legal doctrine under which an individual assumes parental rights, duties, and obligations without going through the formalities of legal adoption. See, it's important to understand the concept of in loco parentis. There are times when your children are in the care of others. During those times, the law recognizes that some parental rights are assumed by the caretakers, though that brings up a couple of interesting questions. First, what are the limitations of in loco parentis rights? Do the caretakers truly assume parental rights, or are they merely delegated a limited number of rights while the children are in their charge? Second, does government have the authority to assume in loco parentis and act against the will of the parents? Since governments have passed laws that require that your children go to school, does that mean the government can transfer your rights as a parent to the school? And if so, what are the limitations of the rights transferred? In the past, it was recognized that a school acting in loco parentis was limited to maintaining the safety of the student in a working educational environment. So a school could discipline a student for fighting or disrupting class, but could not administer medication or authorize medical procedures except in the case where the student was in imminent threat of death or serious bodily harm. However, that view has changed. See, I remember as a child having to take some medication while at school. I had to take the medicine to the school nurse along with a note from my parents. I was required to go to the nurse's office and take the medicine in front of her. I could not even get an aspirin without the nurse contacting one of my parents for permission. Today, we have reports of schools taking children for elective treatments, not only without their parents' permission, but without their knowledge. So this concept of in loco parentis seems to have morphed from a limited power to protect the student to an overruling of parental rights at the sole discretion of the school district. Now, let's discuss the court's opinion on this off-campus speech. Quote, "But three features of off-campus speech often, even if not always, distinguish school efforts to regulate off-campus speech. First, a school will rarely stand in loco parentis when a student speaks off-campus." Okay, according to the court, a school rarely acts as a parent when the student is off-campus. Think of the permission slips we needed our parents to sign before we could go on a field trip. They authorized the school to act in loco parentis while off-campus. Today, while the court says schools rarely stand in loco parentis when a student is off-campus, they're about to contradict themselves. Quote, "Second, from the student speaker's perspective, regulation of off-campus speech, when coupled with regulation of on-campus speech, include all the speech a student utters during the full 24-hour day. That means courts must be more skeptical of a school's effort to regulate off-campus speech. For doing so may mean the students cannot engage in that kind of speech at all." If the school can regulate off-campus speech, then they're acting in loco parentis 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Notice that the opinion states that courts must be much more skeptical of a school's efforts to regulate off-campus speech. Not that the school doesn't have the authority to regulate off-campus speech, even with limited exceptions. This isn't in loco parentis, but pro parentibus, replacing the parents. Quote, "Third, the school itself has an interest in protecting a student's unpopular expression, especially when the expression takes place off campus, because America's public schools are the nurseries of democracy." Public schools don't have an interest in protecting student speech. They have a duty. Schools are institutions of instruction, not nurseries of democracy. Perhaps if the schools these justices went to had spent more time instructing them and less time considering what was in the school's best interest, these men and women would realize not only that America is not a democracy, but that our founding fathers feared that it would become one. As James Madison said, quote, "Hence it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." Now, for those of you who view Justice Thomas as a conservative, well, this dissent may leave you sadly disappointed. Quote, "When students are on campus, the majority says schools have the authority in loco parentis, that is, as substitutes of parents, to discipline speech and conduct. Off campus, the authority of schools is somewhat less. At that level, I generally agree. But the majority omits important detail. What authority does a school have when it operates in loco parentis? How much less authority do schools have over off-campus speech and conduct? And how does a court decide if speech is on or off-campus? Indeed, what authority does a school have off-campus? Are our children property of the state? Does the state have the first word on conduct and behavior of our children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Quote, "A more searching review reveals that schools historically could discipline students in circumstances like those presented here. Because the majority does not attempt to explain why we should not apply this historical rule and does not attempt to tether its approach to anything stable, I respectfully dissent." Once again, Justice Thomas places the opinion of other courts above the rule of law. He didn't dissent because the First Amendment specifically limits Congress or because there is no language in the 14th Amendment to expand that to the states. His argument is that historically, courts have allowed schools to punish students for their off-campus speech. He then goes on to cite examples of state court opinions that state, quote, "A school can regulate speech when it occurs off-campus so long as it has proximate tendency to harm the school, its faculty or students, or its programs." This is from Lander versus Seaver in 1859. Justice Thomas then goes on to claim that BL speech had a direct and imminent tendency to subvert the cheerleading coach's authority. Well, if that's the case, then any disagreement with a teacher or school policy could be regulated as subverting the school's authority. So much for free speech. Now, if BL were my daughter, I would have handled the situation very differently. However, she's not my daughter, so I have no authority to punish her for her actions. And if I cannot do so individually, how can I delegate that authority to a government agent? The question that never seemed to be asked was, does the school have the authority to regulate who participates in school activities, including what qualifications are required? I loathe the idea of government actors regulating the speech of others. However, as the Pennsylvania Constitution notes, we are all responsible for the abusive use of our liberties. We can all speak as we wish, but we are also responsible for the consequences of that speech. When I worked for a corporation, I could be fired for language that was derogatory to that company. In the same vein, BL does not have a right to be a cheerleader. If her actions are derogatory of the school and its extracurricular activities, there should be consequences for that. If BL has shown a tendency to fly off the handle for a decision she disagrees with, what would happen if she disagreed with a referee's call during a game? Could another profanity-laced incident happen out in public? I believe her parents have done BL a disservice. See, rather than taking the opportunity to learn from her mistake and find a way to make amends, they have taught her that the proper response to not getting what she wants is to sue all the way up to the Supreme Court. As for the court, it once again claimed the authority to be above the law. It ignored the language of the First and 14th Amendments in favor of a prior court's interpretation. They ignored the jurisdictional issue, giving future courts another nail in the coffin of judicial supremacy with which to seal our liberties away forever. And while claiming that schools' power of in loco parentis is limited, their actions show that they believe the schools are superior to parents in most situations. Now, whether you agree that BL should have been suspended from cheerleading squad or not, ask yourself these questions. Who are the parents? The real parents or the school? Should there be no consequences for behavior that denigrate a school's activity? And lastly, what is the emotional outburst that should be punished, or the language that should be used? And here we have the conundrum. And sadly, there's not a simple answer to this. From my understanding of the facts, what I've seen and what I've read, the lady in question, BL, denigrated the school and their cheerleading squad. So I don't see punishment of not being allowed to be on the squad for a year as so much a denial of freedom of speech, but as the consequences of that speech. But I also am concerned of a court and a government as a whole that believes that the children belong to them, that schools, public schools, as government entities, have the authority to regulate a child's speech outside of the school or outside of conduct related to the school. I mean, based on what I've read in the opinion, including the dissent, the school could determine that, certain medical advice, certain information is not to be discussed in school or out of school. Commenting on a school's policy, say a mask mandate or a vaccine policy, well, could be considered denigrating the school. See, in an effort, this is the part that I really find amazing. While the court claims that it is upholding free speech, it's actually the saying it has the authority to regulate free speech. And what happens when the government assumes the authority to regulate free speech? Just remember what Psaki said, how that the White House is flagging information, flagging messages for Facebook that they did, that the White House deems to be misinformation. No, I'm not saying that what is misinformation. I'm saying what the White House claims to be misinformation. Now there's more reports that the White House has actually reached out to media outlets about what information they're going to disseminate about vaccines. Is anyone else concerned that if government gets to determine what is and isn't misinformation, freedom of speech is dead?
This is why we have a First Amendment, so that the government, especially the federal government, does not have the authority to infringe on your right to speak freely. And since the executive branch only acts based on laws created by Congress, this is a violation of the First Amendment. This is someone acting under color of law of Congress, assuming the authority to meddle, to restrict your free speech, to coerce others into limiting your free speech. I don't blame Facebook. Facebook's a private entity. They can determine who is and is not, what is and is not allowed on their property. Their platform, as we refer to it, runs on their property. They have servers. They're renting them. Many believe it. They're renting from Amazon, but they have servers. They've invested in code. They've invested in administrative procedures. It is their property. I blame the White House. Actually, you know what I blame? I blame each and every American who is not on the phone and contacting their representative, demanding that the president either cease or face impeachment. Jen Psaki's just admitted to a crime, that the White House is committing a crime by interfering, meddling with the free speech rights of Americans. Now, this is, again, this is that, I don't know, you call it the camel's nose, call it the slippery slope, call it whatever you want. What we have here is government meddling with your free speech, not the consequences of that free speech. In other words, they're not saying, listen, you lied, and in doing so committed fraud, therefore you can be punished for fraud. No, they are saying, we don't like what you're saying. We don't want to allow you the opportunity to say it, and we will restrict whatever platforms we can, be it social media or old school media. This is tyranny. This is the antithesis of the land of the free, the antithesis of liberty. This is government determining good speak versus bad speak. Now, why is this important? Why is this so critical? Well, let's look at an interesting little article that I found. This one came out of the Epoch Times, and it notes that the CDC is to replace the PCR test for COVID. Interesting. Why are they replacing this test? Well, first of all, let's recognize that people for months, if not a year or more, have been pointing to the issues with the PCR test. And back in December of 2020, the World Health Organization finally admitted, they issued a release on December 14th, where they admitted that the PCR test to diagnose COVID-19 is a, quote, hit and miss process with way too many false positives. Now, I want you to, let's put our thinking caps on for a second. We are being told, we've been told for a year and a half that it doesn't matter how many people died, it's how many people test positive. How many people test positive? We have now evidence and we have an admission from the WHO that the PCR test is not reliable, and that it tends to give you a lot of false positives. So let me tell you, have the people for the last year or more that have been telling you there are problems with the PCR test, was that misinformation? Was it disinformation? Or was it just inconvenient information? The people who complained about the accuracy of the PCR test that were eventually found to be accurate was once considered misinformation. So the CDC announces, hey, we're finally going to drop recommendation. We're not going to support the PCR test. They are withdrawing the test from the emergency use authorization. Instead, and this is a quote from the Epoch Times article, instead, they're going to recommend to encourage labs to use a multiplex assay that can detect and differentiate the virus from the flu. Later in the article, according to the CDC, the public health agency as they refer to it, They have released this under this new test under an emergency use authorization. They call it the real-time reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction, or the RT-PCR test, that, quote, detects and differentiates RNA from SARS-CoV-2, influenza A virus, and influenza B virus in upper and lower respiratory specimens. Well, that has to bring up a question. We have a test that has many false positives, and now they want to use a similar test, not exactly the same. This is a real-time reverse transcription. Not quite sure what that means. I'm not a virologist. But a test that now can distinguish between SARS-CoV-2, influenza A, and influenza B. Now, could it be that the previous PCR test was picking up influenza A and influenza B, and it was being identified as COVID? Or could it simply be the other problems they've noted with the test, and that the way it works, you have to repeatedly spin down the sample until you get a detectable amount of virus? Well, who determines how far you spin it down? How many times? See, for months I've been talking about how these tests have been providing false positives, that the case number from the CDC is false. It is inflated. I'm not the only one. I've seen multiple doctors and health organizations complaining that the numbers are inflated. But I thought we were told that was misinformation. Is that the type of misinformation that the White House would have blocked, would have flagged for Facebook, for Twitter, and for the media? See what happens when you place control of what is true in the hands of government. Would we even have known about the PCR test probability problems? Would we even have known about this new test? Would we even have known that the numbers from the CDC are inflated? And when you look at the numbers that come out of the CDC and how low the risk is, and then you realize how inflated those numbers are, you realize there is no emergency. Yes, there's a disease, and there is a small demographic that is highly susceptible to it, but it is not the pandemic and emergency that has been hyped in the media and been hyped by government. And since we're talking about SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19, this would be a good time to remind you to check out HealthyCell.com. I just got my latest shipment of Immune Super Boost and the REM Sleep, and I love it. I'm going to be hitting the road soon for my Knowing Your Rights tour, and I don't want to get sick while I'm on the tour, so I'll be taking Immune Super Boost every day while I'm on the tour, and you can too. It's a nice, easy-to-use, travel-ready gel pack, and it's designed to boost your immune system to ward off whatever you may encounter. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just go to healthycell.com/outloud. You'll automatically get that 20% off your very first order. Maybe you want to try the Immune Super Boost or the REM Sleep or the Focus and Recall. Like I said, I recommend you give the Immune Super Boost a try. I've used it. I like it. I'm sure you will too. Again, go to healthycell.com/outloud for 20% off your very first order.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
America. AmericaOutloud.com is the alternative from the agenda-driven globalist. Here, we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. On-demand podcast or real-time talk radio with our streaming apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. We read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. And today we're talking about free speech. And we've been talking about how the manipulation of free speech impacts not only, well, we talked about schools regulating free speech of students, but we've also been talking about government in general trying to regulate free speech, which brings up an interesting question. Are there limitations to free speech? What are they? And how can they be identified? Now, there is a misconception out there. It's taught all over the place. I encounter it from a lot of people that say the Supreme Court has said that there is a limit on free speech, that you cannot yell fire in a crowded theater. That comes from this the case Schneck versus United States. I have read the opinion. That is not what the opinion says. The opinion has nothing to do with fire or theaters. It has to do with a question: could Congress punish someone for encouraging people to dodge the draft? And in the opinion, they used it as an example. It says it's not a question of free speech. It says you cannot use free speech as a protection from illegal activities. For example, you could not use free speech to protect you from yelling fire in a crowded theater. The distinction is important. See, one controls what you can say. One says you can't use it as a get out of jail free card. For example, we're all familiar, right? If you testify in a court of law, you take an oath and you swear that or affirm that under penalty of perjury, the information you're going to give, the testimony you're going to give, is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We've all heard it on the crime dramas. That's part of the understanding. If you lie under oath, you are denying someone the right to a fair trial. So you can be punished for that. Not that you can't say it, is that there's a punishment for it. And it's an important distinction. Which brings up a very interesting article I found. This one I found on the Daily Caller. I'm sure we're all familiar with Senator Rand Paul. Well, he's apparently sent a letter to the Department of Justice requesting a criminal referral of White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, in a broadcast, in a meeting and a hearing, there was quite a fiery tete-a-tete between the two, in which Senator Paul accused Dr. Fauci of lying to Congress, which he actually pointed out beforehand. He said, you know that lying to Congress is a crime. You've said this turned out to not be true. Do you wish to retract your previous statement? Now, I'm not here to discuss the fiery details of that, but it's an important understanding that no one's saying that Dr. Fauci or anyone else is not free to say what they want. However, that doesn't absolve them of the consequences of what they say. Now, I have a whole other issue with if it's a crime to lie to Congress, is it a crime for Congress to lie to us? See, otherwise, there's no equal protection under the law. But that's a discussion for another day. But we understand libel, slander, defamation, these laws exist because your freedom of speech does not come without consequences, which I think is what was lost in the case that I discussed earlier in the program. But it's important because I've deal with a lot of people who their opinion of rights don't seem to recognize that boundary, that, as I like to say, your legitimate exercise of rights stops when you infringe on the rights of another. In other words, your freedom of speech protects you from whatever you say until you infringe on the rights of someone else. So if you lie, if you defame, if you slander someone, there's a consequence for that. And that's an important understanding. And I'm focusing on freedom of speech today, but this is true of pretty much any right you have. Your right to freedom of press, your right to freedom of religion, your right to keep and bear arms. You think about it, even your right to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures. The limitation being, is it reasonable for government to come search your stuff? How do they prove reasonableness? But if we let the government define what that is, we are no longer government's masters. We are its subjects. We are no longer free citizens. We are enslaved by a government that determines the rules. So I'm kind of curious. I'd love to see Senator Paul make his case. I would love to see the Department of Justice investigate, and I'd love to see Senator Paul make his case. And maybe, just maybe, although I'm not holding my breath, some of the members of the House of Representatives will at least file articles of impeachment against Dr. Fauci if he's lied under oath to Congress. I'd love to see it. Now let's look at this from the other point of view. Representative Green has once again been suspended, had her Twitter account suspended because of something she said. Now, this is where a lot of people disagree with me. I disagree with a lot of people. That's fine. Let's talk about this rationally and reasonably. If my proposition is true, if my point of view is true, that your rights can only legitimately be exercised if they do not infringe on the right of another, the question is, does Twitter have the authority to regulate what goes on their platform, which is their property? Put another way, can Twitter be deprived of control of their property because of what somebody says? That's really what we're talking about. Now, I know a lot of people claim that suddenly Twitter and Facebook and all these are suddenly their public entities, their public utilities. In other words, all of this talk is about depriving all of these big tech companies, all of these social media companies, of their property and of their liberty, not via due process, but by some arbitrary standard, depending on who's making the claim. Now, the way I look at it, if Twitter has a policy that says we're not going to allow this type of information on their platform, as long as that is publicly available, it's not hidden, it's not secret. If they told Ms. Green when she set up her account or at some point afterwards, listen, we will suspend your account if you provide this type of information. That's part of the terms. In other words, the terms of service, the terms of and conditions of an account on Twitter. That's their right. Now, what it means is I don't like Twitter. I don't trust Twitter. I haven't trusted Twitter probably since, for years. But the question is, at what point is a private company no longer a private company? At what point is it become a regulated entity? Is it deprived of control of its property? Now, the other question I have is, was this information for Twitter, that Twitter based this on, was it something that they developed or were they encouraged by the White House or any other part of the government? See, if that's the case, then it's the government actors that should be prosecuted. Yes, I said prosecuted. If the White House, the CDC, or any government actor claim the authority to encourage or bully Twitter into setting a policy, then they have committed a crime. They have deprived Twitter of control of their property without due process of law. They may have engaged in harassment and bullying, but it's a crime. It's not a crime for Twitter to control what's on their platform. It is a crime for government to tell Twitter what can be on their platform or to encourage it. Now, I know a lot of people are now screaming, going, no, it's a public square. No, it's not the public square. It's private property. This is not a publicly owned property. This is a private, it's owned by the people who own shares of Twitter. So let me give you the example. And I had this discussion the other day with someone. Let's say you own a business, little mom and pop business, and Are you allowed to set standards for who can come onto your property? Can you set requirements for people that for their conduct on your property, both customers or employees? In other words, can you set conditions for using or being on your property or working there? Well, as long as that information is made readily available, I would say yes. If you want to have a store and you tell your employees, your potential employees, listen, if you want to work here, you cannot use vulgar language. If you do, there'll be a warning. If you do it a second time, you'll be fired. That's, you know, you say, well, that's infringing on the freedom of speech. No. Well, I should say yes and no. It's the problem is you have a person exercising speech that is depriving you of control of your property. You see, the employee doesn't own the job. The employer does. And especially if that employee is putting a face to the business. In other words, if they're customer facing, either directly or digitally, that is your image. That's your business. So most of us would agree that, you know, you could set certain things. There used to be signs in store windows at the door. You say no shirt, no shoes, no service. And, you know, within reason. And again, reason, right? You can't fraudulently hire someone and then change the rules. There's a lot of stuff that is dealt with. But as a general, as a starting point, shall we say, if we're fair and you're open and you tell them those are the criteria, you're all set. You should be allowed to do that. Same thing for your customers, right? Put a sign in the door. Vulgar language is not allowed on this property. The same way we say smoking's not allowed. There's a lot of, you see the signs all over the place, right? So you're basically saying, listen, this is not allowed. If they come into your place and start swearing, you can say, listen, we don't allow that. Please stop. If they continue, okay, now you're trespassing. Right? You are acting in a way we are not comfortable with. You're no longer wanted here. You are trespassing. And if they don't leave, in most states, as I understand it, if you tell them they're trespassing, leave immediately, and they don't, you can call the police and have them arrested for trespassing. Most people that I talk to are okay with that. The question is, they say, well, but what about what about Walmart? What about Home Depot? What about Kroger? They're big corporations. Yeah, they're big corporations, but they're still owned by people. A corporation, a publicly traded corporation, is owned by people, the same as a private family corporation is owned by people. And those people own that property, the property of the business, the property the business owns. They have the right to control what's on there. So the same thing with Twitter or, again, Facebook or YouTube. They purchased or they rented the computer time, they developed the product, they advertise it, they set terms and conditions. And as long as you agree to those terms and conditions, you're allowed to use a product. And this is the part that I think most people get things a little off. You don't have a right to use Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. You have the opportunity, you have the privilege. They set the conditions of you using their platform. The same way you set the conditions for people using your property. And it doesn't change just because it gets big. When we see a big corporation, we tend to divorce them from the fact that they're owned by individuals. So when we're talking Twitter banning them, it just means that I don't want to do business with Twitter. And in fact, the only reason I actually put content on Twitter is so people can find it. I don't advertise with Twitter. And in fact, there are times when I even question whether I want to post stuff on Twitter because I know they're monetizing my traffic, my content. But that's a decision I have made that says at this point, I will put stuff on Twitter because it's a benefit to me. And as long as Twitter isn't censoring my material, we are in a fair exchange. As soon as Twitter starts censoring my material, I'll stop posting stuff on Twitter. So I look at this, and when I look at this, my concern is not simply that Ms. Green has been censored from Twitter. I believe Twitter has the legal authority to do that. My question is Twitter doing it on their own, or are they acting under government direction to say, this is our policy, we're not going to let you denigrate or contradict what the government says about COVID-19. Now let's take a look at another example. Slightly different example. Saw this just the other day. Just a few hours ago. Saw this on the Federalist. There's a recording of Gavin Newsom, governor of California. He was on CNN, I believe that's where it was, where he compared people who were unvaccinated to drunk drivers. He said, those who've chosen not to get the vaccine are like drunk drivers. Now, I disagree. I think that's a stupid analogy for one simple reason. And since I am not vaccinated, am I an inherent danger to somebody else? In other words, if I'm walking around, am I more dangerous to somebody else than not? Again, this vaccine has not gone through all the FDA testing. It is an emergency use authorization, which means by federal law, you cannot be coerced into taking it. It is a federal crime to coerce somebody or to make a condition of employment or access the taking of a drug under emergency use authorization. Now, that's not what I'm hanging my hat on, but I just want to let everybody to know that. So the question is, am I a danger to those around me? Am I wandering around killing people, injuring people? And the answer is no. First of all, while as a driver on the road, you have no protection against people who are drunk. Whereas if you think the vaccine is great, you have protection. You take the vaccine. Imagine, according to the scientists, according to the doctors, right? The vaccine says, listen, it's going to keep you from getting sick. Or if you do catch the virus, your symptoms will be much milder. Of course, there's already evidence of people who've taken the vaccine and they've tested positive for COVID-19. So again, vaccinated or not vaccinated, it's not the question of drunk driver. Now, does Governor Newsom have the right to say what he said? Yeah, I think it's a stupid analogy. I think it's emotional. It's meant to make an emotional reaction, not a logical one, not a rational one. But he's free to say that. He says, because what did he say? He thinks they're like drunk drivers. Yeah, well, you know, there are people that think the world is flat. You know, there are people that think that we did not go to the moon. There's people that think a lot of things, and they have the right to express that. So I don't wish to shut down Governor Newsom because he says something stupid. Let's face it, if we shut down politicians for saying something stupid, well, then it'd be a lot quieter around here, wouldn't it? So the simple fact that Governor Newsom can't back up his statement with any sort of logical stuff, hey, be my guest. Like I say, better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and prove it. Hey, go for it. And in my next example of free speech questions is an Emily Hines, a student at Louisiana State University, who was kicked out of her sorority for a TikTok post she placed. Now, the sorority says that it doesn't side with political views, but she told the College Fix that she believes the decision was politically motivated. Quoting from an article in the Tennessee Star, says, I think they chose to remove me because my beliefs go against modern society and would look bad on them. Sororities are all about outward appearances. I know firsthand that Alpha Pi is no exception. Okay. She went on to say, they're a private organization, so they can have their own set of rules, but they don't apply to everyone, which is a major fault in their organization as a whole. So what did she do? Well, she reported the incident to LSU's bias reporting system. She did this back in April. But she says LSU has basically ignored this request. Now, LSU, I'm pretty sure since it's Louisiana State University, it's a state university, meaning it's a government university. It is funded by state money. So, again, here's an interesting question. She agrees that the sorority itself is a private organization. They can set their rules. She says that they have done so falsely. They've not applied them equally. They have, in effect, committed fraud. She complained to her school, which is a government entity. She petitioned the government for redress of her grievance, and the school so far apparently has ignored it. And what I find interesting, again, it's just another example. Can we stop the gut reaction of she got kicked off and think, is it that the sorority kicked her out for political reasons, or that it violated their own standards and thereby and the agreement that she had when she joined the sorority? Is it possible that what they actually did was commit fraud? And let's see, I got one more free speech case I want you to consider. This is a coach who's taking his case to the Supreme Court, or at least trying to. See, Coach Joe Kennedy, for years apparently, had a standard practice on his own, would stop and kneel at the 50-yard line after a game. He did not encourage his students to follow. He didn't say anything about it. That was his practice, and he'd done it for numerous seasons. And then somebody decided they were unhappy with that. He was warned, and then he was fired. Now, as of a little while ago, a few days ago, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit declined to rehear en banc a three-judge panel that determined that public school district in Washington State had the right to prevent Coach Joe Kennedy from praying after home games. Now, that you say, well, that sounds more like a freedom of religion, Paul. Yeah, well, you have to understand that freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of press, these are all about expressions. Even the freedom to peaceably assemble is about expressing yourself. That's, you know, the First Amendment is about conscience and your ability to express it. So I haven't gotten into the details of this case yet. I probably will when they, especially if it actually goes to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court accepts the case. But it's, to me, it's an interesting question. See, first of all, it's not a First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution case, again, because I've said Congress shall make no law. This has nothing to do with what Congress has said. This should be a state issue, but it's not, because you make everything a federal issue. But here's the question. Does an individual who works for the state, are they always, is everything they do considered condoned by the state, considered an endorsement by the state? Because that's really what this comes down to. The fact that a government employee prays in public on school grounds, does that mean that the government is establishing a religion? Or on the other hand, is the government now prohibiting the free exercise of religion simply for someone who works for them? And if it's expressing your religion by act or by word, to me, it's very much the same thing. Do you have the right to say what you want as long as you're not antagonizing the school? He isn't complaining about the school in his prayers. He isn't standing up and saying, you know, this school is terrible. Come help me pray to that the school gets better. He isn't doing any of that. He is quietly on his own, walking to the middle of the football field, dropping to a knee and praying. Now, in many cases, many of the students came out and joined him voluntarily. But we come back to your freedom of expression, your freedom to exercise your religion, your freedom to speak, your freedom of press. We need to take some time and think about these more than the knee-jerk reaction of, I like that, I don't like that. Because right now, as much as we have the White House telling Facebook and other media outlets what they should and should not allow on their platform, we have the courts who have for decades told people who work for the government what they can and cannot do, what they can and cannot say. In other words, the ability to regulate speech. Now, this is an interesting one because I really want to get more into the details of this case before I come to a final opinion, because I really can't see both sides. You know, do we want the government determining what religious activities are allowed or not? On the other hand, if he is a if he is doing this on work time, well, then the employer, in this case the school, does have the authority to regulate what he does, how he expresses himself on work time, with certain limitations because it's a government entity, right? So this is a little more complicated. But I wanted to throw it out there, not because I have a nice, quick, easy answer, but because I think it's worth thinking about. So understanding that this case will probably come up in a future episode, please take some time and think. What is your opinion about this? Can you find more details and more information and come up with a cogent argument for or against allowing this man to pray after home games? I think it's an exercise all of us should consider, and not just for this case, but for much of what we hear in the media. You see, we act like the Constitution is going to protect our rights. The Constitution's ink on parchment. It is the law. It is the justification we have for protecting our own rights. You can find out more by going to constitutionstudy.com, find my other articles, videos, and other content that I developed to help you better understand the Constitution and teach it to others and use it in your everyday life. And also, I'm going to ask you to take a look at constitutionscholars.com. It's a website I set up specifically to allow constitutionally minded people to discuss and debate their ideas without unnecessary censorship or manipulation. So that's constitutionscholars.com. It's free to join, and you can find out more on that website. Now, before we go, I want to remind you to make sure that AmericaOutLoud.com is your daily stop for all the latest news, happenings, and other information. It's important that we do our part, that we share these stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos, because it's up to us to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity.
Stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.